email and the internet and even fax machines.
It's almost, yes, it's almost like thinking we had the Pony Express and no electricity. The fact of the matter is, luckily, we had countless volunteers, and we mailed out, snail mailed, thousands of pieces of literature and manuals. Eleanor Norton had we all left for Washington about a day before the march, and Eleanor Norton had to stay in the office the night and the morning of the march to answer phone calls, because we didn't have cell phones and we didn't have call forwarding. And if anything happened, somebody had to be there to answer the question. So we did it in 8 weeks, and we did it because, first of all, the six chairmen of the civil rights organizations put their organizations to organizing for the march. We added four white chairmen from the National Council of Protestant Churches, from the Catholic Interracial Council, from the UAW, and from the American Jewish Congress. And they also put their organizations to work at it. We had Walter with the UAW was also there. So we were able to work through many, many labor unions. The black churches worked at it. We did it in a way that is different than people do things today. That is, we went to organizations, and the organizations mobilized their members. And that's what made it possible. And also, Bayard opened up the office at, I think, at about 8:30 in the morning and closed it at 11 at night. And we worked 6 days a week. And on Sunday, we had a staff meeting. So everybody worked their heads off. And we had tremendous support.
Can you recall once he is named the coordinator and a date, or at least a tentative date, is set for the march? What were the very first things that had to be done? I mean, in those very first meetings or those very first long days that you actually began the nuts and bolts work of putting this event together, where did all of this begin?
We had to get office space. We got donated from the Friendship Baptist Church in New York by Reverend Thomas Kilgore a old building that he wasn't using as a community center called Friendship. I think it's called Friendship House. We had to get the telephones in. We had to get to set up the desk. We had to put out the call to volunteers. Bayard put together an administrative committee. They had to meet to plan everything. We had to plan the manuals. I mean, I actually don't remember what came first. I think we went into a frenzy of activity. It's, okay, guys, here we go. People were on the phone. As I said, Eleanor Norton, I think, was in France. She had been in Mississippi. She went to France on she was a law student on some wonderful boondoggle, and I called her up and said, get home. She left Paris overnight and came to Washington. So it was a frenzy of activities, and then we had to think of procedures. And at every minute, Bayard was very conscious of the fact that we had to be a disciplined march, and we had to make sure that everybody on every level knew exactly what was demanded of them and what we were doing.
At what point and how did you secure what I assume was official permission to hold this march right there in the heart of the National Mall, between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial? Was it just a given that that kind of permission was going to happen, or in fact, was permission required?
Oh, well, yeah, you always need a permit when you work on, when you use the mall and you go on at any of these sites. I didn't participate directly in the negotiations, but I know that eventually the Justice Department and the White House was all involved in these negotiations. And Bayard, I think, went to Washington about once a week to negotiate with people on how the march would take place. Initially, the Kennedy administration was not thrilled about having masses of people in Washington. And in fact, the city was terrified. It never happened before that masses of people masses of black people especially would march on Washington. As Bard said one day, these people see 10 black folks on a street corner and they're afraid there's going to be a riot. So, and also legitimately, the Kennedy people were worried that if anything happened, it would make it more difficult to pass the Civil Rights Bill. So it was very serious opposition in Washington. But eventually, when the administration realized it was going to happen, they started to cooperate. And so there were meetings every week with the Justice Department people to plan the march and plan the route. And our initial plan was that people would march not only from the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Monument, but they would circle the White House. And I was 24 years old, so I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. And the Kennedy administration said, no, 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 you're not going to circle the White House. And Bard agreed to that. And he came back, and I think those of us on the staff that were young complained, oh, Bard, how could you give that up? And he just said, now, now, if we have hundreds of thousands of people there, it doesn't matter whether we walk around the White House or not, as long as we're there and our presence is known. And he was, of course, right. We did win an argument with the Justice Department. I had been on the earlier marches, and there I was, the transportation coordinator, and I was the person who couldn't find my bus on the earlier marches. I am sort of dyslexic about direction. It's really true. So I told Bard that if we wanted to make sure that people could be would leave in a quickly, and that there would be no trouble, that wherever the buses drop people off, they had to stay there, and the bus captains would have everybody write down the location of the bus. And Bard explained that to the Justice Department people, and I guess the park police, and they said, no, 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 buses always drop people off, and then they go park someplace else. And Bard said, see here, my transportation director assures me there will be bedlam if so much as one bus is moved. And lo and behold, for the first and only time in history, buses dropped people off near the malls and parked very close by. In fact, there's a program which shows their parking spaces. Now buses go to RFK Stadium. Nobody stays in the mall. So we ultimately worked out all the policing, got all the permits, and in fact, Bard wanted the staff people to stay around after the march and clean up some of the litter just to make sure how wonderful and disciplined we were. We didn't do it. We shall overcome and left it to the police.
You were, as you've already said, the transportation coordinator for this. What were your primary responsibilities in terms of, I mean, I'm sure you worked on all sorts of facets of the march, but specifically, what were your responsibilities in regards to that title?
It was my job to make sure that every organization that wanted a bus, train, or plane got one. And it sounds easy, but in those days, you had to make sure, well, first you had to make sure that the buses had interstate licenses so that it was legal for them to cross state lines. School buses, for instance, were not the best thing to use to go from Chicago to Washington. And you had to make sure that the company was integrated. We didn't want to use companies that just one day only said, okay, we're going to, let black folks in the front of the bus. And so it was my job to make sure that the organizations and the bus companies got put together. And it was also, I didn't really help individuals get on the bus, but occasionally just to let somebody know, to let a small church in Brooklyn know that there was a bigger church down the block or three blocks away that was organizing for the march. And then to answer any questions that came up. And it was an era where there was certainly more cooperation in the north. So we realized at some point that there were going to be carpools. And either Mr. Randolph or Bard got in touch with the governor's office in New York, and the governor was a liberal Republican, Nelson Rockefeller, and he helped make sure that on the New York State Thruway, people who worked in toll booths would give leaflets out to cars that with drivers that were coming down to the march, telling them where to go and where the line of march was and where they should park, because we realized late in the game that there were people coming to the march who hadn't bothered to tell us they were coming, and they were just getting in their car and driving.
I think that's one of the things that is particularly remarkable, is we think about this event now that we look back on in retrospect, and we know the scope of it in terms of, or to some rough extent at least, we know how many people ultimately descended on Washington. But you who were organizing the march had no way of being absolutely certain. You probably had a guess and you had your hopes that it would be a massive event, but there was no way to absolutely know how many people would ultimately make their way to Washington. And I think that in it of itself, that uncertainty had to have been a kind of a difficult reality with which to wrestle.
Actually, it was a very pleasant reality when it hit us. I gave Byard a memo about a week before the march, or maybe 4 days, 5 days before the march, where I calculated, based on what I knew, the buses charted, the captains of the buses, a listing of how many people would be there, and I came up with the grand figure of 67,000 or something, and I was really depressed by that, and I managed to depress Byard and everybody else in the office because we had called for 100,000, and of course we were hoping for more. Luckily, my depression was soon ended because Byard went to a meeting of the chairman, and Roy Wilkins looked at that memo and said, "Does she really know about 67,000?" And Byard said, "Yeah." And Mr. Wilkins said, "Hot damn, we're going over the top." And it was Roy Wilkins who realized that I had no idea about the people who were driving in their own cars and carpooling. I had no idea about the people who were using Greyhound buses and public transportation. And I didn't know who was going to come in Washington. And that made us very happy that I was wrong. And certainly the day of the march, we were really pleased to see that there were that many people. And it was because of that discussion that Byard went to Governor Rockefeller to ask for the leaflets. We then began to make provisions for that. So the more people, the more opportunity.
Mm. One thing that is interesting in the film is that the morning of the march, evidently Washington in those very, very early hours was still its normal self. I mean, there were a few people, but really a relatively tiny number of people who seemed to be there for the march. And the film conveys the impression that for many of the staff, maybe you among them, it was disconcerting. I mean, you sort of have, it's like when you clean your house for a party and then it's a minute after and nobody's there yet and you wonder if anybody's going to come. And then, of course, people do come to the party. And ultimately, any momentary misgivings early that morning were quickly erased when people begin descending on Washington by the tens of thousands.
Exactly. It's exactly that moment when you know they're going to, they've said they're going to come, but are they going to come? And in fact, Washington was quieter than it usually is because they had closed down the whole city in fear of what would happen. Businesses were closed. It was a Wednesday. Hospitals were not doing any elective surgery. The National Guard was called out on the periphery. Byard said they couldn't monitor our march, but in case there were counter demonstrations, the Kennedy administration could worry about that. And we get to the mall at 6:30 and 7, and I know that the trains aren't coming in till 8:30, but nobody's there except us, you know, people, volunteers and some of our marshals. And the press, of course, is hanging around, and they're there, and they're saying to Byard, "Mr. Rustin, Mr. Rustin, is anybody coming?" And Byard picked up a pad and looked at a pocket watch he carried, looked at the watch, looked at the pad, and announced to the assembled press, "We are absolutely on schedule." And then he put it all down. And I said, "What are you looking at?" And he said, "Nothing." He just faked it. And so it was really, but pretty soon, and I just remember it, that pretty soon, sort of the Washington Monument and the Sullivan Theater where we were assembling is a little bit on the hill, I literally started to hear freedom songs. And it was all of a sudden these people coming over the hill and singing. It was probably one of the best sights of my whole life.
Sights and sounds.
And sound, exactly.
Did you have a specific responsibility that day? I mean, during the march itself and that dramatic program at the Lincoln Memorial?
At the beginning of the march, it was my job, to stay at the Sylvan Theater and on the telephone. And as Bayard said, if there are any crises on the road, you're handling them. And of course, two bus drivers or captains called and said their buses had broken down, and I handled it in my usual mechanical, scientific way. I said, hitch rides, and that's what they did, and they all came in. And then for the rest of the day, you saw, one did what Bayard asked you to do. Remember, there's no cell phones. So if you had to find John Lewis, five of us had to run around and find John Lewis. Or if Bobby Darin couldn't find his way to the podium, you had to take him there. And luckily, the crowd was so disciplined and so accommodating. I had a little badge that said staff, and I would walk through and everybody would clear the way. And finally, there was a bus that took those of us on the staff, sort of behind the line of march, to the Lincoln Memorial. And then we were able to be on the podium when the program began and to really become participants. Hmm.
One thing that I deeply regret is that most of us, and I'm among them, I suppose, only know that event from Martin Luther King's magnificent speech, when in fact all kinds of things happened. It was a long, varied, interesting program. I wonder, as you look back on that entire program at the Lincoln Memorial in particular, if anything stands out to you apart from Dr. King's marvelous and famous speech.
Well, of course, it's a Dr. King speech, which has given this march its immortality. But there were brilliant speeches made that day. It would really be good if people heard A. Philip Randolph's speech for jobs and economic justice. It is a speech that holds up today, alas. The Rabbi Yochanan Prince gave a speech directed mostly to white folks who sat on the periphery. And he had been the rabbi in Berlin when Hitler came to power. And he said that and said that he came to worry most about people who did not participate and sat by and watched these crimes take place. There was John Lewis's speech, which parts of which were considered too militant, but which was also a very striking and great speech. And then, of course, the march ended with Bayard reading the 10 demands of the march. And they were demands for a higher minimum wage, for integrated housing, for voter rights, for school integration. And those were important then, and certainly voting rights and the jobs demands are something we shouldn't lose sight of today. Mm.
I wonder if, as a woman at the time, you were bothered by the fact that none of the speakers, or at least official speakers that day on that long program, was a woman. And do you recall that if that matter was seriously discussed at the time?
Yeah, and yes, it was. But let me first tell you that it's not true that none of the speakers were women. It's sort of a myth that has traveled the country. There were, because Dorothy Height, I mean, there were real problems. This is 1963, and the black community was much like the white community in the sense of feminism had not yet started. Dorothy Height was the newly elected head of the National Council of Negro Women. She had not yet had time to establish it as an equal participant in the struggle for civil rights and equality with the other organizations. But Dorothy was a good soldier and was on the administrative committee of the march. There clearly there were complaints from Dorothy Height and other women that why isn't there a woman chairman, although Dorothy raised it once and then stopped. But Mr. Randolph and Bayard, and I'm sure Dorothy Height, felt that there were women who were really active in the movement and who had suffered and should be honored. So there was a segment of the march honoring black women in the struggle, Gloria Richardson of Cambridge, Diane Nash of Tennessee, Mrs. Medgar Evers, Mrs. Herbert Lee, who were widows of martyrs, Rosa Parks, and Daisy Bates, who had been the organizer and was the head of the NAACP in Little Rock and had organized the integration of Central High School. the day of the march, Mrs. Medgar Evers was supposed to speak on the program at the same time as all the leaders. She got caught in traffic, and Daisy Bates spoke instead. Now, Daisy Bates spoke in the official program, on the official program, in the lineup with the leaders. And Daisy Bates was no shrinking violet. And she got up and she said on behalf of, and then named every black women's organization that participated, as if to say to the black leaders, listen to me. And then she said, we will sit in, we will march, we will participate. And she gives a stem-winding speech. And she's in the films, and she's on Google, and she's there. And everybody forgets her, and it really aggravates me. Daisy gave a great speech. Having said that, from the vantage point of 2013, should Dorothy Hyde have been a chairperson? Of course. But, you know, it was a different era. It was an era, by the way, when Mr. Randolph spoke before the National Press Club a few weeks before the march, Evelyn Cunningham, who was a great black reporter, called him up and said, do you know that women are not admitted to the National Press Club? Women. And Mr. Randolph sort of said, oops, and he or Byard called, and they said, Mr. Randolph will not speak at the press club unless women can be in the audience. And for that day, they allowed women to go and listen to Mr. Randolph. And it wasn't for a few years later that women were admitted to the National Press Club. So we weren't only in the dark ages, technologically speaking. There were other people.
No kidding.
No kidding.
And of course, in addition to what you've just said, and I'm so happy to have inadvertently, I suppose, given you the opportunity to dispel that myth.
Yeah.
But we should also acknowledge the fact that also on the podium that day were many musicians, and most of them women. Mahalia Jackson, Odetta, Marian
right.
Anderson, Camilla Williams.
Right. Lena Horne.
Yes, playing a very significant role in what transpired that day. As you look back on the March on Washington, does it feel like 50 years ago? I mean, does it feel like another era, or does it feel like yesterday, or some mix of the two?
It's both. It feels like yesterday, and it is another era. For instance, Byard would be astounded at what's going on today. First of all, that here is the man who was not invited to the White House with the other leaders getting a Medal of Freedom from an African-American president. That is just mind-boggling when you think of the change. And secondly, that here in Washington, D.C., which was closed down during the march, this week is a virtual festival of march events. There are seminars, marches, meetings, church meetings, a march on the 24th, and the President of the United States is going to speak at the Lincoln Memorial on the 28th. That is an incredible change from what happened 50 years ago. But, of course, we all have to stop and think that the Supreme Court has gutted the Voter Rights Act, that the unemployment statistics among black youth is absolutely terrible, and there is much work to be done.
Finishing out today's morning show here on WGTD, I want to play for you the conclusion of my conversation with Mark Cushman, the author of a series of three books about Star Trek, the original series, called These Are the Voyages, meticulously researched books in which he takes us behind the scenes of the formation, the creation of each and every episode from this groundbreaking series. And Volume 3 focuses on the third season, a very difficult season, as the producers of the program faced the encroachment of limited budgets, the defection of a number of important key figures in the creation of Star Trek, and growing discontent and morale problems among the cast as the producers of the show continued to try to create a high-quality program against increasingly difficult odds. One of the most dramatic moments from the third season came in an episode called Plato's Stepchildren, in which four members of the USS Enterprise crew are held captive by a race that is able to exert control over them through telekinetic means. And one of the things which occurs in a very dramatic moment is when Captain Kirk is forced to kiss his communication officer, Lieutenant Uhura. Captain Kirk being white, Lieutenant Uhura being black. This was a incredibly important first in network television. The first time, at least in a scripted situation, that a black person was seen kissing a white person on network television.
In the script, it had Kirk is kissing Uhura. Well, the network fought that. They said, well, we can't have that happen. And everyone says, why? And then they realize, oh, because he's white and she's black, I see. And you know, NBC was doing I Spy at the time, the first show that had a white and a black actor working opposite each other in equal billing and sharing motel rooms as they traveled around the world. But, you know, to have these two people kiss is a whole different thing. And so they said, well, can he kiss Nurse Chapel? And we'll have Spock kiss Uhura. And
so it would be an alien kissing a black woman instead of a
pointed-eared guy to kiss the black woman, but not the other guy. You know, so they fought it, and finally the network said, "Okay, do it." Well, the networks have different levels of censorship. There's different offices, and so one office approved it, and then it gets up to the West Coast office. Finally, said, "Okay, do it." And then it's the day before they're going to shoot that scene, and somebody at the New York office takes a look at it and says, wait a minute, how did this get by? We can't do this. And they fly out there, and they're on the set, and they're getting ready to shoot the scene, and it's the last scene they're shooting that day, and it's almost 6:20. And they're saying, you know, you can't do this, you can't do this. And Roddenberry comes down to the set, and there's a big fight. And, you know, he was called, and he drove over from MGM again because this was very important to him, and to Fred Freiberger as well, who's the real champion of wanting to get that scene in. And they said, well, look, you know, we'll fight about it later. Let's shoot it two ways. We'll shoot it where he just kisses her on the cheek, and we'll shoot it where he kisses her on the lips. And then we'll fight with you and decide which one can go into the episode. So they shoot the real kiss first. Now it's about 6:15. They got time for one more take before the guys are going to start turning the lights off. Douglas Kramer people are going to be switching the lights off. And so they only get one chance to shoot the fake kiss. And they do it. It looks fine. The NBC people are happy. They leave. What they don't see is that when Uhura and Kirk kiss, William Shatner has the camera facing him. And he looks into the camera as he's kissing her on the cheek, and he crosses his eyes. And they do one take. So now the next day they're looking at the dailies, and it's like, oh, we can't use that. We have no choice. We only have one scene to use. We have to do the kiss. So they put it on the air, and everybody held their breath nervously. And over the next week or two, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of letters actually came in. People wrote letters to TV Guide about it. And I print some letters in the book there on this episode. And a couple of them say, Star Trek went too far the other night. But most of the letters were very, very supportive of this, saying, hooray for Star Trek. Finally, somebody is saying, look, she's a beautiful woman, and what the heck? So, you know, that was one of those things where the cast, William Shatner, by crossing his eyes into the camera as he was doing the fake kiss on that very last shot that they could do that day, made it to where they had to use the real kiss in that episode.
One thing that you explain, and I'm so glad you do, is something that had always struck me as so odd, and it's in the episode Let This Be Their Last Battlefield, which we have these two aliens from two different races, but in both cases, they are split down the middle, black and white, but in reverse of each other. But they see each other as utterly two different races. And, of course, it's a very interesting take on the whole notion of racism. But there is this long sequence towards the end of that episode in which one is pursuing the other through the corridors of the Enterprise, and it goes on forever. It goes on and on and on and on. And I've always wondered all these years why in the world that happened, why they wasted so much time with this pursuit that never seems to end. And your book explains exactly why that happened.
Right. I'm the same as you, Greg. I have to turn over every rock. Every stone gets turned over as I watch these things and say, why was this decision made? And there's an episode, you know, it goes on for a few minutes, but it seems like hours, that these two actors are chasing each other down the corridors of the Enterprise. Well, what happened was, you know, they were so over budget at this point, and Fred Freiberger was trying so much to bring the show in on budget, that they started writing the script shorter. Because they would usually do about a 64-page script, and then they could trim it down to fit into a 50-minute time slot. And sometimes a scene would get filmed and get left on the editing room floor, or they would have to trim a lot of lines. But that made for the episodes to be tighter and have a nice pace to them. Well, by the time you get halfway into the third season, they're realizing we just cannot afford to be shooting stuff we're not going to use. So they started writing the scripts to be shorter, and that particular script was 54 pages, which was a little on the light side. And when they ended up editing it, they found out they were a couple minutes short for the 50 minutes that they needed for airing. And so they took that scene. Well, we had a lot of shots of them running up and down the quarters. We'll just pad it. We'll extend this out. That's why that thing ended up being as long as it was. That episode is so interesting for a couple reasons. First of all, the fans are divided. Some love it, and some think it's a little too camp. I love it. I feel that, you know, racial bigotry is so absurd. I mean, we can hate people for a lot of reasons and probably be justified, but, you know, just to hate somebody for the color of their skin is a whole different subject. And so if you're going to make commentary on that, why not do it and show the absurdity of it? And I love that scene where they're talking to Frank Gorshin in the briefing room, and he's the ambassador who's come to try to take the other guy back in irons. And he says, his people, his kind. He keeps saying his kind. And Shatner says, I don't understand. When you keep saying his kind, he's like you. He's black on one side and white on the other. And Frank Gorshin looks at him and says, are you blind? You know, his people are black on the right side. My people are white on the right side. All of his people are black on the right side. And I think it's just a wonderful, wonderful statement that they made in that. But here's the interesting thing. 1 week before they started filming this episode, it was a guy who looked like an angel and a guy who looked like a devil. And they brought in Judd Taylor to direct, and he's having his pre-production meeting with Fred Freiberger and Art Singer. And he's saying, you know, this is a little too obvious. We know that the guy who looks like the devil is going to end up being the more righteous of the two. It's just, you know, we just know it. See, can we be a little more clever? And well, what do you think? And he says, what if one's white and half black, and we do it that way? And Fred Freiberger looked at Art Singer and said, that's good. He said, go rewrite the script. And so just days before they're going to pull the trigger on this one, Art Singer's back there pounding out a new draft, and Fred Freiberger has to rewrite it. And it's a complete rewrite of a Gene Kuhn script. They totally had to change it as they're pre-producing it, getting ready to film, and they have to devise the makeup and everything else. So it was done that quickly. You know, there's an example of creative producers who hear a good idea, realize they can make a good statement with this idea, and just go with it, even in the last moments as they're preparing. And there's a lot of wrong information, Greg, out there on the Internet. That's one of the reasons why I want to do these books, is all the true information is in the show files. It's just nobody ever took time to go through them. All the true information is in the Nielsen ratings reports. Nobody took time or wanted to spend any money to license them. So I wanted to get to the truth. And there's a lot of information out there that this episode was actually a rewrite of one from the first season that NBC wouldn't allow them to shoot, called Portrait of Black and White. And it's not at all. Portrait of Black and White was Gene Roddenberry's idea, written by Barry Trivers. And it was, they beamed down to a planet that is a parallel of Earth, and it's pre-Civil War. And blacks are the ruling race, and whites are slaves. And the away team is taken captive and put in chains and sold as slaves. And the network said, we can't do this. This is just too edgy. So they tried to get that done. They rewrote it, tried to get it done in the second season, still couldn't get it done. And so in the third year, Gene Kuhn came in with this other story, which was totally different. But in the pre-production stage, it turned into a racial story and a racial theme.
Ultimately, the third season, as are the first and second seasons as well, a mix of hits and misses. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's just that in the third season, there are more misses than there were in the previous seasons, but they're still interesting to write about. Let me give you a moment to just specify your least favorite episode in the third season and your favorite episode in the third season.
Well, most people I don't think it's quite as bad as a lot of people think, although it gets pretty bad towards the end. But Spock's brain is notorious for being the worst Star Trek episode ever made, and that's from the third year. And that's where they take Spock's brain out of his head and some alien race, and they use it to run their computer system on their planet, their life support. And people thought, what were they thinking? This is just too campy. It's too silly. And maybe it should have been done as a comedy. But, you know, you had the mandate from Roddenberry, no humor in the third year. And they snuck in a little bit, but he didn't really want to play it for laughs like episodes like Trouble with Tribbles did during the second year. So, but what happened? See, I want to know where all these ideas came from. What were they thinking? That's what I want to know. And that's what's interesting for me to write about and find. And what had happened with that one is just a couple weeks before they came up with the idea, the first heart transplant took place. And it was big news all around the world, and people were out protesting this. Man does not have the right to play God. And Gene Roddenberry and Gene Kuhn were sitting in the office, and they looked at each other and thought, we have to do something with this. Well, 200 years from now, heart transplants aren't going to be anything new, and we're doing kidney transplants. What could it be? And that's when they said, a brain transplant. So you can see, it's hard to say that with a straight face, because even now we look back, well, brain transplant, that sounds silly. But at that moment, when you're looking at these headlines and people are out in the street carrying signs and yelling and all this, you know, the police are being called in and everything else, you're seeing this as potential for a very interesting, provocative episode. So that's where that one came from. So it's fun for me to see this. Now, the space hippies, well, that, I would have to vote that as probably the worst episode of the season and the series. But again, you know, you're looking at what was going on in 1968 when they came up with that idea in 1969 when they filmed it, and you know all the protesting going on and America coming apart at the seams and this different culture that's coming up, and Star Trek was a show that wanted to stay on top of all this and make commentary on all these things, and they did a very interesting thing in that episode. And the fact that the guy who's the leader of these space hippies and they're trying to find this mythical planet Eden where they can live and get away from all the technology, they're rebelling against the technology of this era. And he has a disease that is being caused by the artificial environments and the artificial food and all the artificial everything that has been created to sustain life. And it's created a new disease, and he's a carrier of this disease, and he's angry about it. Well, we're kind of facing that right now. Things that Star Trek was predicting are coming up. So even when you see an episode like that, which is maybe the worst, it still has elements that are very intriguing. And I think that's why Star Trek's still around 50 years later, is a lot of thought went into these scripts, even the ones that were turkeys.
Hmm. Your favorite episode?
I think the third season has some excellent episodes. You know, one thing Fred Freiberger did is he brought in a lot of women writers. Prior to the third season, you only had two. You had Dorothy Fontana, who was Gene Roddenberry's secretary, and he promoted her to writer. She had always wanted to write, and she had done a couple scripts for a few other shows. So she became a full-time writer at Star Trek and wrote some of their best episodes and then became the series script consultant during the second year. And you had Margaret Armin, who they brought in to do a couple scripts. Well, Fred Freiberger brought in half a dozen other women during the third season, Judy Burns, Jean Lucetta Rosta, Joyce Muscat. I interviewed all of them for the book. The only person who ever interviewed Jean or Joyce, I had to really track them down to find out where their ideas for the scripts came from. And so he, you know, they did stories that were a lot more sensitive and stories that women could enjoy as well, that, because they couldn't do the action adventure as much as they were in the past. So they did very interesting stories like Is There in Truth No Beauty? And The Empath, which was Gene Roddenberry's favorite episode of the entire season and DeForest Kelley's favorite as well. And that was a third season episode. I think those are excellent episodes. I think Tholian Webb is a really good episode. I think Spectre of the Gun. Now, you know, I showed that to Susan Osborne, who was my editor on these books. And she had not seen all the Star Treks, and that's why she was selected. Because it was like, well, we need somebody who doesn't know Star Trek so they can make sure that this stuff is interesting beyond just being about Star Trek. It's about the struggle of making a TV show, and it's about the times. And she saw that episode, and she said, I like this better than any episode I've ever seen. It's so surreal. It's so interesting. And by the way, here's an interesting story about Spectre of the Gun. And that's the one where they're forced to go back to Tombstone, Arizona, as a punishment for violating, for invading this section of space where they've been told to stay out, and these aliens don't want anything to do with humankind. And in the script, it wasn't filmed this way. They had to take it out at NBC's insistence. But in the script, the reason these aliens don't want to have anything to do with mankind is because they're picking up television from the 1960s. It's taken that many years for the TV signals to get out there. And so they're watching 1950s and 1960s television shows, and they're seeing the violence and the recklessness of the human race. And suddenly these Earth people appear, and we want nothing to do with you. And that's why they chose Tombstone, Arizona as their punishment. We're going to make you live and die in your own history. Fascinating concept. Well, the network said, well, we got to take that out because it makes it look like we're putting bad programming on the air, and the FCC won't like it. So they took that element out of the story. It's a shame. So I recreate for you all the things that they tried to do. We look at what they did, but we also look at what they were trying to do with a lot of these episodes.
It really is quite fascinating. And it was trickier with this third season because there was a little less of a paper trail. You tell us that many of the conversations and discussions actually happened over the phone versus in endless memos. And so in many cases, you have to do the hard work of looking at old versions and new versions and compare and contrast how these scripts ultimately came into their final form.
Right. A lot of my work was done for me in the first two books, but even the beginning of the third book, because Gene Roddenberry wrote long memos, and Gene Kuhn wrote long memos, and Bob Justman did too. Well, Bob Justman was still there during the third year, and his memos are delightful. He should have been a stand-up comic. He really wrote funny memos. And so you're hearing their thinking as they're developing the scripts, and you're seeing what they're saying about the problems they're dealing with and how are we going to do this and so forth. Well, by the halfway point of the third year, the memos started drying up because Fred Freiberger was a telephone guy. You know, he thought, look, I got to rewrite all these scripts. I don't have time to be writing 20-page memos on each draft of each script. Roddenberry's out of the office. Justman's still there. He's still writing his memos. But you don't have quite as many memos during those last dozen episodes, certainly. But I interviewed everyone I could find. And as you said, I would go through the different drafts of the scripts. And you still have the censor reports coming in from the network and so forth. So you can recreate the thinking that was going on between these shows.
And I think it's important to say that you are not only sharing this with us, but in a sense, you're helping us appreciate, albeit maybe grudgingly, the input from, for instance, the network, that the guy at NBC, for a long time it was Stan Robertson, and then someone else stepped in to offer the network's concerns about given episodes. In many cases, he's offering insights that are just as perceptive as anything that's being said by those on the creative team. And it flies in the face of what we often think of, you know, that the guy from the network with the clipboard, who's the big crab and the big skeptic, is just out of touch with these wonderful artistic instincts that we have. In fact, that's being simplistic to paint it in those kind of terms.
There were no bad guys. You know, one of the things Star Trek did, and you remember the famous episode Devil in the Dark with the Horta, who was perceived as a monster. It's killing people until we find out at the end of the episode we're killing its babies. You know, it's a mother defending its children. And so that's one of the things Roddenberry wanted to do, is he said, look, even monsters have reasons for what they do. And NBC was the monster, and Paramount was the monster with Star Trek. But monsters have reasons for what they do. They're not just coming in wanting to kill. They're killing because they think their survival is dependent upon it. So in writing anything, as a screenwriter, I would do it, and writing these books, is you got to understand all your characters, and you have to find the motivation of all your characters. And there are no bad guys. It's just differences of opinion, you know? Roddenberry wants as much money as he can. He was proud of the fact that the first Star Trek pilot was the most expensive show ever made, and there's a quote in the first book from him where he said to one of the people on the crew, he said, well, this may ruin the studio, but if it doesn't, we're going to have a hell of a show. Mm-hmm. Well, but the studio's got a different idea. The studio is, no, we don't want to be ruined. You know, so that's the battle. Those are the battle lines right there. But that what makes show a good. You mentioned Stan Robertson of NBC. You know, NBC always just gets blamed for being bad. But you know what? Yes, they canceled the show. But it was NBC that was insistent that the show be action-adventure. And so you see a lot of memos from NBC, from Stan Robertson, saying, let's quicken up the pace. Let's put in some more action here. Let's put in more conflict here. This story is too reminiscent of one that you did last year. Can you change it? Can you make it different? And things of that nature. And sometimes not just saying, can you do it, but you'll see Stan Robertson making very excellent suggestions on how it can be changed.
Hmm.
So it was a collaboration, very uneasy collaboration, but a collaboration nonetheless that made Star Trek what it was.
So are you finished? You are obviously finished in terms of these three books and the three seasons of the original series. Do you foresee yourself crafting some other kind of Star Trek book in the future, or is it too early
Absolutely.
To be thinking about that?
No, I'm deep into it. It's funny, I did a book signing the other day over at the Shrine Auditorium, and somebody came up and on Sunday and said, okay, I'm going to buy all three. I've been waiting. I've been wanting to buy the first two. I keep reading things about them and everything. But he says, but I didn't want to buy them just in case you didn't finish the third one. I didn't want to get into it and then not have the whole story. So you can relax. The whole story's there. All three seasons are now covered. We go all the way up to the cancellation. But here's what happened for me. As I'm writing the last chapter of the third book, and I didn't want to end with just the show getting killed, because even though we all know it survives and it comes back, it still seemed like kind of a downbeat way to end the book. So I started writing about what happened immediately after. And the next thing I know, I have a 100-page chapter. And they're saying, wait a minute. These books are too big as it is, and this third book is the biggest one of all, and there's no way, you know, we're going to do this. But I knew that as well. I thought, I can't do this. So I took it out and just put in, stay tuned. The story's not over yet. And I started expanding and opening up that last chapter, and it's 200 pages now, and it'll be 400 pages before I'm done, because I'm just going to give you a little tease of what the fourth book is going to be. And nobody has to wait for the fourth book, because you have the whole series now examined, and every single episode, we know what everyone was thinking and what battles they had to fight with every single episode. We know the ratings, we know everything. But the story of Star Trek doesn't end there. And what happened is, within a year of canceling the show, NBC wanted it back. They tried to get it back on the air. And Paramount, hiss, wouldn't do it. Because Paramount's saying, wait a minute, we have a major hit on our hands here. This thing is the number one show in syndication. It's the number one show around the world. Money is pouring in. And if we start making new episodes, it's going to diminish the value of the reruns. It wouldn't have, of course, but they thought it would. And so they refused to put it back on the air as an hour-long show. NBC was talking to them within 6 months of the show ending. The first conversation was, they said, well, let's do a movie for next season. Let's do a two-hour Star Trek movie every year for TV. And then it was, no, we want it back as a series within 6 months. And NBC kept saying, no. Or I'm sorry, Paramount said no. So finally in 73, they said, well, we'll give it back to you as an animated show for Saturday mornings. All the original cast, everything else, same writers, great quality, it won an Emmy, but that won't compete. So there was this interesting battle going on with Star Trek right after it left the air that I never knew about, but again, it's all in the show files, it's in the papers, it's in the people that I've been talking to, and things of that nature, and a lot of other interesting stuff that I won't tell you that happened in the 10 years between Star Trek getting canceled and Star Trek the motion picture getting on the big screen, that why it took 10 years and all the ups and downs and twists and turns in the story of Star Trek. And so that's going to be a fourth book, which we're jokingly calling These Are the Voyages, etc. Hopefully you'll come up with a better title.
Right. I'll start thinking about that, as will others at your publisher, of course. In the meantime, the third volume and final volume in this particular group of books, These Are the Voyages, chronicling the original series of Star Trek, is now available, and the author, Mark Cushman. Mark Cushman, once again, a great pleasure for me to speak with you about your beautifully crafted, meticulously researched book, and
thank you,
I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, we'll talk about et cetera in a year or so.
Sounds good.
All right, Greg.
859, this is WGTD HD. Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and Classical Music on your gateway to public radio. We're going to join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming here in just a matter of seconds. Look for a sunny morning, then a cloudy afternoon, a high heading for 37. Right now, pretty nice out. 33 degrees Racine, 28 Kenosha, 25 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.